Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Afterword. I'm Dave Tisch. I want to tell a story about the very first time I ever heard a pastor cuss. I was a sophomore in high school. I went on a trip with a youth group. My best friend, Eric, he was a grade ahead of me. He was in the youth group. He invited me to go. I went. And during this trip, we went through Philadelphia. And during the time, the leaders of this group wanted us not just to have fun and enjoy ourselves, but the leaders of the trip, the youth pastor on the trip, wanted to show us some of the work that had been going on in the city that was being done by Christians. So we got to visit a homeless shelter. And in that homeless shelter, there was in downtown Philly, there was a shelter for battered women that the church and a local Christian ministry had built. And it was a home for battered women. And I think this is the first time I learned about that. And it was just rough. It was a really challenging thing to hear. A guy by the name of Hector, who was the director of it, and also it appeared to be the primary carpenter. He was the one who built out the rooms and made sure that there was enough space for the women. And he was super passionate about adding rooms because each room represented a new woman that they could admit into the program whose life could be changed. And here we are, a bunch of high schoolers hearing about battered women escaping violence and having nowhere to go and having their children with them. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, it was jarring. Like, I just kind of just wanted to go to the Phillies game later that night. You know, that's what I was hoping for. And then go to the water park. I hadn't factored in the possibility I might get walloped on the side of my head by God showing me what the church can really look like. And during that time, during that trip, our youth pastor also took us to, I think it was Eastern University. It was in outside of Philly, in Pennsylvania, where there was a pastor there that he really respected named Tony Campolo. Tony Campolo, kind of a famous American sociologist. He was a Baptist pastor, an author of multiple books, and kind of an influential figure. So Campolo was kind of an important and popular commentator on kind of the way that politics and social issues in Christianity collide. And he was not super popular all the time. So there we are. We're a youth group, a bunch of kids. And he begins talking about the relief work he was doing in Haiti. And Haiti at the time was experiencing an explosion of AIDS, the AIDS virus. And when he went down there to get on the plane, as he was going on the tarmac, a woman ran toward him with her baby and tried to give him her baby so that the baby would live, because the baby had contracted AIDS from her gestationally in the womb, and there was no access for her to have antiviral drugs. And so she was going to die, she knew, but the baby, if it went to the U.S., might be able to get some medicine. So she was there on the in the airport pleading with Campolo to take her baby so that her baby would live. And we're just all shocked at this. And he told us that there was like something like 38,000 Haitians that had AIDS, and so many X number of them were infants and children. So he's telling us the story about this woman. And he's telling us the story, and he says, and most of the Christians I know don't give a boop about this. And he dropped a word, an S word. It means poop. And it rhymes with fit. And yeah, that's what he said. He says, most of the Christians that I know, most Christian leaders, they don't give a flying flip about this issue. Only he said a bad word. He said the S word. And then he looked at us and he goes, and the thing that most makes me mad is that your youth pastors, and that most of you are going to go home and you're going to be more upset that I said the S word in front of you as a pastor than you are that there's so many people dying in Haiti and no one caring. I think what he was trying to do was awaken us to this reality. And to be honest, I mean, here I am talking about the story, but Campolo made his point to us. And yes, our youth leaders were angry. And yes, they actually wrote and told all the parents, we're very sorry about this. And Mr. Campolo cursed in front of the kids, and we're really sorry about that. But honestly, none of us minded. We saw the point that Tony was trying to get through to us, is that sometimes language has to be used to clarify your values. To be fair, I don't think Tony actually blasphemed in any way. Steve Clifford used to say this all the time when we'd have conversations with high schoolers about what words are okay to use. He says, never use language to disparage something that you personally hold very, very sacred. So, for example, using the Lord's name in vain, or calling somebody a name that demeans them. For example, there are a lot of vulgar words out there that demean human beings. But the S word is just poop. And there's nothing sacred about poop. It's just biological excrement. And to be fair, what Campolo was trying to do was use powerful, strong language to awaken us, like smelling salts, so that we could see what was in front of us and awaken us to a spiritual reality. In this case, that human lives affected by AIDS were actually far more important than the fact that a pastor used the S word in front of a bunch of high schoolers who, frankly, let's be honest, had all heard that term and, frankly, probably used it too much, more than we should. The reason I say this is because this week, Paul kind of uses the S word. In Philippians 3, Paul says, "But whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What's more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things." And then Paul says the bad word, "I consider them garbage that I may gain Christ." Now, this word garbage is the Greek word skubala, which basically means refuse, filth, or poop. It's a strong, in the words of some scholars, a PG-13 word that Paul is using to shock his listeners to see, because Paul is trying to get them to see that everything he's accomplished in his life is worthless when compared to the surpassing worth of knowing who Jesus is and Jesus' reality in Paul's world. He's saying that Jesus is by far, far in a way, he's so valuable in his life that anything else that he attains in his life is like garbage in comparison. So, I guess you could say that Paul uses the S word. In fact, I kind of do. I kind of like that he did. Because I kind of like that he did. Anyway, we're here to talk about that. I've got Mark Averill in the studio. We're going to talk about this and a whole lot more. And so with that, let's just dive right in.
Yes.
So
indeed. I don't know this. Yeah. I'll probably be something.
You have a nice timbre to your voice.
Timbre.
Timbre?
It's spelled T-I-M, but it's timbre.
Did I just get corrected? So hold on. T-I-M-B-R-E, and it's pronounced timbre?
Yeah. It's a musical. I mean, we use it all the time.
Wow. So I'm completely wrong.
It's timbre.
Wow. Okay. Well, you have a nice timbre to your voice.
Thank you.
A resonance. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Afterword. Here with Mark Averill,
yes.
The one, the only.
So glad. Anytime I could spend time with you.
Well, anytime I can spend time with you.
Come on.
Oh, actually, but you're limping a bit.
Yeah, I got to go to the doctor.
You think you have a hernia, a sports hernia?
Yes, I'd like to say it was something glorious. Like I was,
it's a sports hernia.
I was dunking or something
Yeah,
like
no,
that.
It was, you went up, you were trying to hit from the 10 and you just came down weird and you felt something. Have you ever had a hernia surgery?
No, my son, Taylor, actually had double hernia surgery when he was really little.
Yeah. So
I don't know if it's a genetic thing that I just came to late in life.
Speaking of Taylor, your son's on the Olympic team.
He is.
How do you feel about that? Being the dad of an Olympian, does that make you feel like an Olympian a little bit?
Not even close, but it does.
Oh, it doesn't? I would totally own that.
No, I don't feel like an Olympian. I do feel, obviously pride. And, you know, I was talking with him a little bit about the team and what's it like, you know, they're trying to get ready, but they got some injuries and stuff like
Uh-oh.
That. Because they are literally, the U.S. team for volleyball is the oldest team. Their average age is like 34, I think he said, 32, 33, something like that. So we've got like a 39-year-old.
Whoa.
They're veterans. They've won multiple times and are medalists, but they are older and their bodies are
happens. You got to rest. So they're going to be in, that's Paris, right?
Yeah.
Are you and Lisa going to try to go over or is that impossible?
No, I mean, we worked it out. We're going to fly over there. And because of how volleyball works, their schedule, they're pretty much there from opening ceremonies to closing if they make the gold
medal. Right, because it goes on forever, right?
So long, because they play every other day.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, we'll be there for it. So
I... I'm telling you, I remember like in 1988, 1992, watching the U.S. Olympic men's volleyball team, like with like Karch Karai.
Tim Timmons.
Yeah, Tim Timmons, I think.
Was it Tim?
Yeah. The redheaded with the flat top. I adored that. I don't know why. I watched every game. I was a huge fan.
Yeah.
I think volleyball is probably one of the best Olympic sports definitely out there. So much fun.
When you were in Hawaii, that's a big sport to watch.
It's the national sport of Hawaii, and everyone plays.
Yeah.
And the thing about volleyball that I love, and by the way, when I was a teacher, my favorite students were always volleyball students.
Huh.
If they were student athletes, I'm saying my favorite student athletes were volleyball players, men or male or female, because it's such a team sport. You cannot play volleyball and win without team. Yep. It's impossible. It's not like basketball. You can dominate ball hog.
Right.
Same with football. The quarterback, the wide receiver, running back, those guys get most of the reps. I mean, it's not, it is a team sport, but you can kind of pretend like it is. Volleyball, not so much.
Yeah.
It just, everybody, the setter, the back row specialist, the defensive specialist, the front row, the hitters, all of them. The hitters actually are probably get the most reps.
They get the most attention, partly because they're the final part of a play.
But it's also, that's kind of the most sexy because they hit so hard and it's really cool.
And they jump so high.
They
some of those
do.
Guys went like, when you watch the Brazilian team or even, there's some guy on the USA national team where the net is a minor inconvenience. It's like at their chest.
At their chest, yeah.
You know, so it's, you watch that and they soar through the air. It's awesome.
I have often thought, what if we took, if volleyball were as big as the NBA, if we had our very best athletes play volleyball. Think about Shaq as middle blocker.
It's a doorway. It was like stuff. It would be monster blocks after monster
blocks. I just don't understand how you would even get it past him, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, that's exciting. So you guys are going to go over and try to watch him as much as you can.
We are.
That's super exciting.
Looking forward to it.
Well, so everyone, if you tune in to the 2024 Olympics this August, root for men's USA volleyball and Taylor Averill.
In the middle.
Right in the middle. Does he still have his bad mustache?
He does.
I don't like it.
I know it.
I guess it makes him look like Glenn Powell in Top Gun Maverick or something.
He's holding on to it. He is not letting go of it for anything. But yeah.
Okay. It's fun. Well, we are here, not only to talk about basketball, but we're here to talk about Philippians.
Yeah.
We are in our passage this week, which is interesting because we got to say a bad word, which is rare.
Skubalon.
I've seen it spelled Skybalon and Skubala.
Yeah.
But it's the word that Paul uses, and it's an evocative word.
Yeah.
He says,
vulgar.
Yeah, it's a it's a PG-13 word, yes. I think Scott McKnight said.
That's right.
I count everything as garbage.
Yeah.
Basically, refuse, filth, poo-poo.
Yeah.
Compared to the surpassing beauty of knowing Christ.
Yeah.
And he's talking about his achievements. But this passage, how would you summarize? Let's just summarize for the folks. How would you summarize what Paul is saying in this passage in Philippians?
Yeah, I mean, our main landing points, I think, were pretty helpful. You know, look out for those ways that you may really dive into your identity and validity through achievement. Through accomplishing things. So look out for that. Look to Christ and the value knowing him. And then this perpetual sense of looking forward, pressing on. I do think it's the overall arc of Christ. You know, you got crucifixion, resurrection by being united with Christ. He even talks about being, the power of Christ's resurrection. But then ascension, moving forward, upwards, to the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. So I think it's an overall kind of biblical Christ arc of dying, experiencing new life, and then ascension, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting in this letter, Philippians is so light and full of joy.
Yeah.
And in our passage, it kind of switches for a second where Paul turns really sharp, not toward the Philippians, but toward those, he calls them dogs.
Yeah.
And that's not... This is sad to say. I did a study on this. Dogs is not a positive thing in the Bible. The Bible is not pro-dog. It's not.
So what did you see? Because that's one place I didn't.
It's every time it's a negative connotation. If you can imagine like jackals or hyenas, like what what you think of with jackals and hyenas, kind of scavenger,
ravenous,
dangerous,
yeah,
dirty, following like dirty and death. That's what they think of in the ancient world as dogs. They're not cute pets.
I was gonna say our view is, you know, little puppies.
Oh sure, that's not
golden retriever,
or even like seeing eye dogs, like they're deeply, or police dogs that are like super awesome, you know. But that's not how the Bible, the Bible is actually kind of anti-dog and made me sad in my heart. So, that is. But he calls them dogs, and he's talking about, what would we, you and I would call the Judaizers.
Right.
We're just trying to put some context in, mostly because it doesn't really relate to us. I was thinking about it. The danger relates to us, but not the specific danger.
Right.
So like there's these Jewish people who follow around Paul and they say, listen, in order for you to be united with God, you have to
observe the law,
yep,
observe the Sabbath, dietary laws, you know?
They talk about the big three, around the time of Jesus, most rabbinic teaching, because I think what was happening, and this is a bit of a weird historical deep dive, the Jews had been pushed out of Jerusalem. And so there's the diaspora, all these Jews are dispersed. So the question is, how can we remain faithful to God if we can't go to the temple because it's 1,000 miles away? Mm. How do we maintain dietary law if we can't get the right food because we're no longer near like kosher places to get it? And how do we observe circumcision if, I mean, we're among a bunch of people who don't circumcise, right? So it's Sabbath law, dietary law, and circumcision, which if you think about, so kind of what you do with your food, what you do with your Sunday, and what you do with your foreskin. But
did you just say that?
I did. I just said foreskin on a podcast. There it is. But if you think about it, each one of those is external. Like Sabbath is an external, diet is external, and circumcision, you can have all three of those and not be transformed internally, right? So Paul is really, really keen on those things will not get you closer to God. They're external observances. They're signposts and boundary markers for who's in, and they're the wrong ones. He's like, the actual right one is being united with Christ and sharing with him and his suffering and his glory.
That's a good way.
So that's kind of, but that's not our problem today.
Right.
And so Paul goes and he's like, oh, you want to be Jewish?
Let's play that game.
And what's he say? At one point, he's like, I have reasons more than any of you. and he's like, and it doesn't matter. Yeah. That's not what counts. In fact, Paul goes even so far as to say, I was like an enemy of Christ.
Right.
So
zealous and persecuted the church. And
so that's not great. Now, but that's what they were dealing with. And I think what you and I kind of came down on is like, that's not our issue today. But the idea of trying to achieve our way to God, that kind of does map on. Like, how have you seen that? And now you use the word attachments or achievement and attachments. Talk about how you think about achievement and attachments as a spiritual danger for us today, just as that was the idea of you have to become Jewish and keep all the Jewish law in order to get close to God. How does attachments and achievement, how is that a spiritual danger for us today?
I think one's a subset of the other. I think attachments, there's all different ones you can have. You know, achievement is one, acquiring material possessions
is a way to...
You're saying
attachment is the broader category.
I think it is.
And achievement would be a subset.
I think it is.
Okay, I got it. Okay.
Yeah, you know... ways of validating yourself, of trying to earn some sense of pleasure. It's the very essence of a false idol, something you look to for salvation.
So when you say the word attachment, it's synonymous with idol. Could you give me a definition that you have in your head for what attachment might mean? Or when you think about the word attachment, because I'm like, I'm attached to my kid. You're attached to your kid.
I think unhealthy attachment is the difference.
Okay, so unhealthy, meaning it's like it's higher than it should be?
Yeah, I think anything that takes the substitute of God as an idol or an unhealthy attachment, it does something deep at a soul level for us that substitutes a good thing even with an ultimate thing of God and his place in our lives and experiencing his power in resurrection and... So
it's something that has too much power or too much hold on us more than it should.
A substitute for,
or tries to fill the role that only God can fill.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. I love what you were saying. It's like, how do I know if I'm okay? How do I know if I'm good enough?
Right.
How do I know if I'm have what I need? And if the answer is anything other than, I think Paul is trying to get us to see anything other than God,
right,
we've got like a problem, because not because it's like God gets mad at us. It's because those are, it's empty cisterns. They're not, they're, right, they can't possibly hold the weight of that. So, okay. So talk through some of the ones you said achievement. What are some other ones that you've seen?
I think even approval from people.
Of course, for sure.
You know, achievement, accomplishments, I guess, would kind of be in there as well. It really is anything that you see that's a substitute for the place God should have. So there's good things. You know, you mentioned, you know, your kids. Yeah, you want to be attached there. It's a good loving attachment. But there are also things that do some rupture to us in a soul way and don't connect us to God.
We've all seen parents who, I've even been this parent. Like, for example, when your kid does something wrong and it reflects poorly on you and you sure. get mad at them, not because what they did is wrong or it's harmful to them,
yeah.
but because it made you look bad.
Absolutely.
So that's an example of unhealthy. Like a healthy parent would say, look, I know that was embarrassing, but the real issue is my kid just lied in school.
Right.
And so let me try to figure out how to deal with that. But when you get, I would get really mad because it made me look bad. And that's unhealthy. And so, or you care too much about your kid's success. You know,
How it reflects on
how it reflects on you. My kid got into that or didn't get into that. And so therefore I'm embarrassed by that, or I'm too proud of that.
Is why I think it's so important when he says I'm in Christ, that he's actually rooting his identity in something that's not temporal, that's not, based off. I mean, when he says in the flesh, you know, that's all the things that we can accomplish in our human effort. So it's basically anything that's human effort oriented, is going to be temporal and takes us away from the true identity of being sons and daughters, and our identity not being linked to something that's fleeting or can come and go kind of thing.
Okay, I want to ask you a question on this one. There's a guy named Steve Cuss. He's phenomenal. He came and spoke to our staff a number of years ago. He's actually an Australian guy, but he lives actually in Colorado.
Love the accent.
Yeah, I do. I do too. But more than that, he's done a ton of work. He's actually got a great podcast called Being Human. Mm. And one of the things he says is there can be a difference. And this goes to your attachments thing. Mm. There is a difference between our most important thing that we believe and our most precious thing that we believe.
Mm.
And there's often a delta. He says, I would say to you, my most precious belief is that Jesus is my King and my Lord. He's trying to say, I agree with what Paul is saying, but in the practical working out of this, what I see is that that's not actually true. That my most driving belief or my most important belief is that I have to achieve in order to be okay.
Mm.
Or if somebody's mad at me, I'm not okay.
Mm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, we are double-minded. We say this, he said, Jesus really is my most precious belief. And I want that to be true, but it's not. But then identifying where that delta is really, really hard work.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about how we can get to the point where we can see what kinds of things. I mean, I guess in some ways, like just some advice that makes it seem like it's a short, I don't mean to say, give me a quick fix on this, because I don't think it is a quick fix.
No.
I think it's long, hard, deep work with God. But how can you identify when your most precious belief that Paul's trying to get us to see actually isn't quite your most important or most driving belief?
I like that as a way to kind of get into thinking. To me, it's one of the things that's helped is to live in somewhat of a contemplative, reflective way that tries to notice a couple things. I try to notice in myself if there's any areas of compulsion, because that's a good indicator that there may be something operating underneath the hood that is
like when you're driven for something that really, really important to you, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's not that it could be wrong. It's just a good place to ask yourself the question when you're compulsive about something, is this a good, go under the hood, and is there a motivation there? Is there something else you're trying to get that should be achieved through another way. So it's kind of a rooting thing. Like, am I being rooted in the right thing here? Or is it just, yeah, is it revealing anything to me?
Yeah, I love that. I love it. It reminds me of two things. First, my seminary professor, Gary Brashear, has talked about our heart. The word for heart in kind of the biblical Hebrew is basically means your control panel, what drives you. Mm-hmm. And so if you're being driven towards something and that something isn't God, it's a great way to notice that maybe your heart's a little off wired. You know, you got your wires crossed. We've all been there.
Yeah.
Something has become so that, but man, that's hard work. And really it takes a lot of introspection. And sometimes we can't really see it that easily.
Which is why I think when we talk about spiritual friendships, those are some of the places that people can help us notice that if they hear it in us, because you can hear that sometimes in people, not that I can know their heart or motive, but it might make me ask the question, is there something else in operation here for you to attend to? And a spiritual friend can be somebody who can call that out and notice that.
Well, I mean, we leak as humans. We leak. We just, I don't know how else to say it, man. We leak out. What's in us leaks out if we spend enough time. And if you're safe with somebody, you're going to leak out. And they could pick up both on the beauty, the fear, and also the stuff that I think maybe God might want to have his finger on, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, it reminds me of a story. I remember a friend of mine was telling me they were talking to a lead pastor and they started talking and all of a sudden the lead pastor said to him, you're really connected to your resume, because he kept telling all the things he'd done and the individual didn't realize that he was putting that much of himself out. So that question helped him kind of step back and go, yeah, why do I feel like I have to give you my resume when I'm talking to you? Why do I have to tell you the things I've accomplished? Is there something else I'm trying to get from that? Trying to control, trying to secure? I think those are good places to ask those kind of questions.
Yeah.
And open yourself up to, am I being rooted in the right thing? Is there an emotional identity thing that's in operation here that I need to pay attention to? The other thing I think it's helpful is the idea of watching, do I have any disproportionate reactions or emotions to something when I don't get it?
I love it. Okay, so compulsion's the first thing. And then the second thing is notice extreme reactions.
Reactions to it. Unmeasured, they don't really warrant.
Just really powerful emotions. Just pay attention to that, because notice it could it. Be. Because whenever, here's what happened. Tim Keller says this all the time, and he's like really good on this. He says that idols are so important, so when they get threatened, what is the natural response when something important to you gets threatened?
Right.
Is anger.
Yeah.
So if you get extraordinarily angry
depression,
at something,
you know, if it's taking you to a dark place because it's a blocked goal in some ways. Well, is that the right goal is the question, you know?
I remember this is years ago, and this is just an example that comes to mind. I was kind of the young adults pastor, so college and young professionals at a church. And this woman comes up and she's very put together and she's like, I'm really excited. I got a job interview tomorrow. And I want you to pray. And I want you to pray I would get it, you know, get this job. And I'm like, okay, cool. So I'm like praying, you know, God, you know, she's worked really hard. She's up for this if it's your will. And she stopped me. Huh. And she's like, I don't know. It's, I need this. So this, it's not God's will. Let's not
declare
pray that.
This. Declare it.
She's like, this has to happen.
Yeah.
And then I was like, whoa. I'm like, it was almost like she was telling God, this better happen.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa. So then I started going like, why is this so important? And then she's like, you know, I've worked really hard, and if I don't, then it's this. And it was this real strong, angry kind of thing. Mm. And I was just like, whoa. And I was just like, well, what if you don't get it? And she's like, well, let's not even entertain that. I'm like, no, let's entertain it. What would that mean? Does that mean that God doesn't care? Mm. Does that mean that God's not working? Does that mean that God's forgotten you? Does that mean you give up on God? And those edges were like really extreme, you know, and she's just like, well, and then that helped her see, I put a lot of stock in this promotion, this job promotion. Like, why is that? And not that it's wrong to
want to,
yeah, but it was like way too important.
Yeah.
So those are kind of, that's the emotional reaction. It was,
well, and I loved the diagnostic questions. You know, the truth is, I definitely don't know your motivations. I barely know mine.
The idea that we're a mess of motivations.
Yeah. But I think the questions you ask when there is such a, like in that circumstance, such a sense of kind of almost demanding and trying to get that guarantee that God's going to work a certain way. There's something there that feels a little disproportionate that, you know, I have examples all over the world of people not getting what they want, not even getting the food they need and stuff like that. So that a strong attachment to it's got this outcome, that outcome needs to happen like this. I loved your questions. I think those are good questions to ask ourselves when we step back and go, wow, I dug into that pretty hard. Was there something else maybe that is underneath that that might be unhealthy, an attachment that's going to take me in a kind of more of a darker place?
Okay, so compulsions, paying attention to what's kind of driving us, extreme reactions. Is there anything, is another category? I mean, by the way, that's enough. I just wanted to make sure that is there another one?
Yeah, that's just where I start.
Can I throw out one?
Yeah, yeah.
I think when suffering hits, how we respond reveals what's most important, what's truest in us. I think suffering has a unique way of honing us and kind of rousing in us, like, what do I actually believe about God and about life? So like how I respond to suffering, I think might be, or for me, it's been like the third kind of indicator light. Like, what do I actually believe? If my world falls apart, if I get to, you know, then all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, what I said I believed and what I actually believe are kind of different here.
I absolutely agree. The only thing I think maybe to add to that is be very gentle and patient with yourself. Because in suffering, I think you have another layer of pain that can make it really hard to dissect that. And it's one of the places where I think, not that I think you were leaning that way, but one of the places where those around us feel uncomfortable with another person's suffering and want to offer the trite kind of things that say, okay, get to the end, get to where you know you should be with this. And I think when we find ourselves in that place, moving slowly and kindly with ourselves.
And with those who are suffering, obviously.
Yeah. And not that you implied otherwise. I just think I agree.
No, it's
with
just
you.
The caution. Like, this is delicate, painful work.
Yeah.
So be gentle. Which, let's talk about that, which goes to spiritual friendships.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The whole idea of a friend is not, I mean, friends encourage, but friends also kind of, they don't beat you over the head with it. They're patient and loyal. They don't like jet out on you when you make a mistake. That's the whole point of this.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about spiritual friendships, because let's be honest, we're dudes. A lot of dudes, and it's Father's Day, a lot of guys don't have spiritual friendships.
Yeah.
There's a sense of isolation. I remember growing up, and I mean this, Mark, my dad didn't have any friends ever.
You said that. That's interesting.
Like, he had this guy named Joe that he sometimes talked to. That's it. And his brother, sort of. Like, that was it. He had coworkers. My dad had zero friendships. Like, zero. And it's like, I've seen male isolation up close. I know what it does. So, I mean, you've seen it too, all over the place. So, I guess, is there an encouragement or a warning and encouragement? I'm not sure what to say. What would you say to dudes?
Well, as we kind of coached our way through it a little bit in the teaching, but I think just that idea of the necessity to make intention with it. I heard somebody say this to me, and it kind of underlined what I felt. Like, I think we have this sense that, oh, I'm a cool guy. People will want to be friends with me. They'll reach out to me and make the initiative. And this individual said he sees it as 80% his responsibility to be the initiator of it. And I think when he said that to me, I was like, yeah, that's kind of my experience.
Was this a mentor that said this to you?
It was another guy at Westgate.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting.
I just thought he said, an older individual. I thought there was some wisdom in that. That's because I think we tend to think, oh, the other person's going to make the first move. And I think to make it work, if we both feel a little bit of that 80%, then it's going to work. You know what I mean? We're kind of,
wow, 80. He didn't. That's pretty lopsided.
It is. And I think the 20% is you're too needy if it's 100%.
No.
That's
right.
A good place to
right,
be.
Right.
But I think 80.
Well, it's also be a one-sided relationship. But the other person never reaches out.
Yes. Not
so
healthy.
So that's not healthy.
No, that's not a good. That's too clingy.
But I guess what they're trying to get you to do is see it as mostly majority your responsibility to reach out and to connect.
And I find most of the time,
guys just aren't good at that.
No, they're not. Until life, what I find happens is they kind of like, no, I'm good. I got it. I got it. I'm
until,
good.
Until
I'm
you
good.
Don't.
Until it's not. Yeah, until it's not good. Yeah, and then you're kind of like, well, then it's weird to turn and go, hey, I got it.
Well, now you're in pain and now you have less resources to reach out.
Yes.
So that's really bad.
Yeah. I think guys have to be intentional about it. And kind of think in terms of slowly peeling the onion away. You know, we have some great ways at Westgate meetups, you know, your small group, but even in a small group, as you get to know a person, you know, kind of testing the waters. Hey, let's go have coffee. I know we see each other every week or every other week, and slowly starting to peel the onion away and learn, can I trust this person with a little bit of me? Can I trust them with a little bit more? And get a feel for, maybe this is just my golf buddy. This is a guy I go out and, you know, we go to ball games with or something like that. That's totally cool too. But looking for, is there any person who kind of shares those deeper values and we connect at kind of a chemistry level as right. well as a level of, I trust them as I give them a little bit more of myself, open some of my life up. And it can just take time. That's the problem. I don't think people... They want it, the time, we want it fast, right? It's gotta be a happy meal. It's gotta be quick.
And not to be weird about this, but you're not going to be besties with everybody.
Right.
And David Kim wrote a book called, you know, Made to Belong. And he talks about chemistry being the second most important part. The first part is what you kind of said, commitment. I'm going to commit to being a guy who has friends.
Yes.
Who has spiritual friendships and people who speak into my life. Committing, that gets you that's the one of the most important things.
Intention of that. Yeah, that's really good.
But then the second part is chemistry, meaning not every dude, like it's okay.
Yeah.
Like you and I connect over a million different things, music, sports. We're both NBA heads, you know? So that's an easy thing.
Yeah.
That's an unforced thing.
But
thanks, Mark.
No, I was going to say, but you and I have waded into waters where, tell me about your family. You know, we've gone another level. That's what gets us in the door, where it gets us in comfort really quick.
Yeah.
But then you're a welcoming presence, and it's easy to ask you about things. You came up to me and asked some health things to me. You know, it's like,
well, I just put it on the podcast there, Mark. I just told everyone you've got a hernia. So if there's any laparoscopic doctors out there or surgeons, Mark Averill is looking for a surgery.
Mark at westgatechurch.org. Find me. Help me. Yeah. No, but I just think that there's something about being that kind of welcoming presence for somebody else. And testing. Can I share with Dave? You know, you shared some stuff with me just the other day. And you're like, oh, he's trusting me with something that's a little below the NBA surface, you know?
Totally. Kind
of, and then you're like, okay, that gives me permission. And kind of looking for those kind of cues.
Yeah, it's critical. And, you know, our dear friend, my mentor, Steve Clifford, said, the Christian life isn't difficult to do alone. It's impossible. He said that a million times because I think he was trying to get people to see, like, this literally cannot be done. You can't understand your own compulsions, your own motivations, your own extreme reactions. Yeah. Sometimes we're not even aware we're having an extreme reaction. We don't understand how we respond in suffering, and we need the light of other people, other friends, Christian friends, brothers and sisters to help us in this and to call out in us. I mean, because sometimes we just spiral into bad places, all those kinds of things. Yeah. Well, again, the point of all this is to live in such a way as we can say that Paul says that Jesus is actually our prize, that he is our most important thing, that he actually, the surpassing knowledge of knowing Jesus or the surpassing joy of knowing Jesus, that's our most important thing. It just takes a long time to get there.
Which is why I love how Paul says, I haven't obtained it.
I love that.
Already made perfect. I'm not there yet.
Being gentle on himself.
Yeah.
I love that. He's like, look, because it sounds like when he starts off, he's like, you want to talk about Jewish? I'll tell you about Jewish.
Yeah.
I'm the best of the best. But then on this one, he's like, look, I haven't attained this, but I'm pressing on. I'm running. So let's all run together. Yeah. And I love that. I love it. It's a really light pastoral, but I love what the word you said was gentle. He's being gentle, but also, hey, this is our direction.
Right.
So there's a little bit of encouragement and an edge, but there's also a tremendous, like let's press on. Let's take a step today to get better. And then tomorrow we'll take another step.
I would encourage everybody. I think this passage is a great companion for your journey because I think it wraps up so much of the ways that we get pulled into things that are unhealthy in our spiritual lives and drawn back to a deep unity in Christ. But then also this sense of we're in process, be patient with us, but look to the left and right, and with the people, brothers and sisters, let's keep pressing on. Just it's such a good grounding passage.
Yeah.
One that for me, I've just found it over and over and recycled it over and over in my life.
And it has a curse word in it. So that's nice.
Come on, just kidding.
You got it. Yeah, you got it. Well, actually, it's got two kind of strong words. He calls the Judaizers dogs.
That's right.
And then he says, I consider it all. I love what you said. You said, I could tell you what it means, but then the elders and Jay would kick the scuba out of me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are done with this podcast. Mark Averill, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, man.
I hope that this podcast wasn't scuba, but was actually helpful to you out there. And
if not, you can give it to the dogs.
All right. We'll talk to you next week, man. See you soon.
Bye.
Just want to say thanks to Mark Averill for stopping by. Join me next week when Jay Kim will be joining me as we talk about the next section of Philippians. And then we're on the home stretch. We only got two more weeks after that. So, pretty exciting. So we'll see you next week.